just put on my, there it is, put on my radio voice for you all. Or my dad voice. They're actually remarkably similar. All right, we are, Lord willing, finishing up chapter 9 of Hebrews today. There's a lot to get through, especially since there's a couple more things I think we should talk about in verses 1 through 14 that we just didn't have quite enough time to get to, and so we'll do that this evening. Before we jump into all of that, Micah, if you would open us with a word of prayer, please.
Lord and God and Father in heaven, we thank you so much for the day that you've blessed us with. We ask that you be with us as we open up and feast on your word. We are so thankful for your divine revelation in which we can see more clearly into the mystery of the gospel and how from the beginning it was your plan to redeem us. We are so thankful for the sacrifice of your son and all the spiritual blessings we have through him. It's in his name that we pray. Amen.
Amen. So, as we mentioned, some would say that the section we are in right now is kind of the very heart of this whole sermon. And this is talking about that the new and better order of things under the high priesthood of Jesus offers us a better covenant because of better sacrifices and better promises. And so, man, chapters 9 and 10 really are, it's when all of those pieces start kind of clicking into place and you go, oh, he's been building towards this, but not just the author of Hebrews has been building towards this, but God, the author of everything, has been building towards all of this. And I love these chapters. They help me kind of fit a lot of these things in place. We talked about last time, the first portion of chapter 9 really deals with the tabernacle. And he goes into just a little bit, he could have gone into much more detail, but he goes into just a little bit about the outline of that structure and some of the items that were there. I did just want to bring out, we talked about in the Holy of Holies, what was in that room? Well, so inside of the tabernacle was the Ark of the Covenant. And inside of the Ark of the Covenant was, okay, Aaron's staff. Yep, the two tablets of stone and the manna. And all of those are significant. I think the author of Hebrews, he brushes over several other things, but he does make sure to mention those three things inside of the ark. The tablets of the covenant, and we talked about this a little bit, but the tablets contained one word that is used for this, the Decalogue. Deca meaning 10, logos meaning word or words, the 10 words as they are sometimes referred to, which was itself a summary of the entire law. And so you think about, since the law was the stipulations of the covenant between God and Israel, and the tablets containing the Ten Commandments were rightly called the tablets of the covenant, note where they were. The Ten Commandments were in the ark, and the ark was in the Holy of Holies, which was behind the curtain of the holy place. They were placed almost as far away from the people themselves as they could be. Contrast that with what God said through Jeremiah. Where would the word be in the new covenant? What did Jeremiah say? Yes. The word in the old law was given to the people, but it really was, in many senses, kind of tucked away. But in the new covenant, the word's going to be inside of our very hearts. That's where God is going to keep those commandments. And I thought that that was really interesting. And then we talked about where is the ark now? Unless you believe what Indiana Jones says, it's not in a warehouse somewhere. In fact, we don't hear about it or read about it after the Babylonians. And in fact, Josephus said of the most holy place of the Jerusalem temple, there's nothing in it at all, he said in the first century. And that shouldn't surprise us. And this is one of the verses that I failed to mention last time, along with the verse that Micah reminded me of. Jeremiah actually said in Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 16, "When you have multiplied and been fruitful in the land, in those days, declares the Lord, they shall no more say, 'The ark of the covenant of the Lord.' It shall not come to mind or be remembered or missed. It shall not be made again." There's going to come a time, he says, where you're not even going to care about where it is, because the covenant isn't going to be represented by that thing anymore. God has a grander design. And so it's not as big of a deal as many of us have made it out to be, or Indiana Jones made it out to be. Years later, when the prophet Haggai spoke to the people to encourage them, so Haggai was prophesying to the exiles, they had come back into the land, and he's scolding them for not finishing the work of rebuilding the temple, and he says this: "The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, says the Lord of hosts, and in this place I will give peace, declares the Lord of hosts." And there's a temporary sense in which that was true. They were reconstructing a temple, but do you remember what was the reaction of the people when the foundation of that new temple was laid? Especially the reaction from the generation that remembered Solomon's temple. How did they feel about it?
In general, it was a mixed reaction, but there were some who were mourning that it didn't have the splendor of the prior.
It wasn't as good as Solomon. So some, the younger generation that didn't know what to compare it to, were thrilled with it. The older generation saw it, and they wept. There is a temporary sense in which Haggai says is true. Eventually, that temple would be renewed and expanded under Herod. And so this is the temple that was around when Jesus was there, and it was incredibly impressive. What happened to that temple? 70 AD rolled around, and what happened? It is gone. There literally is not a single stone upon another. All that remains is the platform on which it sat on. We call it the Temple Mount. That's it. All the structures, all the buildings, just like Jesus said, are all gone. So how could Haggai say this, that the temple would be better? Well, what did God have in mind as far as the temple in the new covenant? We've alluded to it a couple of times here in this class. Where is the temple today? We are the temple. So it's no longer where the presence of God would dwell above the mercy seat tucked back in this room that only one person could see every year. God actually has chosen to dwell within each of us. And that's impressive. Yeah, we've got a comment up here, Micah.
It's really important too, because if you go back and you watch the tabernacle and the temple, that was holy ground. And you did not dare disrespect or destroy anything in the temple.
Yes.
You respected it and you took care of it just as God said. So if we're the temple of God, we are holy ground.
Yes.
And we need to make sure that we're respecting and not destroying anything in the temple of God.
Yes.
Or we'll be just as responsible as the people who would do that to the temple or the tabernacle.
Absolutely. So one of these passages up here, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, "Do you not know that you are God's temple and that God's spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy and you are that temple." So we can use this passage to make a lot of application. I'm not going to go necessarily too far into this, but the things that I do to my body, I should always keep this truth in mind, that the Spirit of the Lord is said to now dwell in me, in you. And so how are we treating God's temple? And so Haggai was right. that the latter days, that the temple would be even more incredible than it ever was. Yes, I'm sorry.
When we think back to God's first interaction with the Israelites after they came out of Egypt, he was trying to be right there with them.
Yes.
He wasn't trying to be tucked away in a corner. He said,
yes.
Hey, y'all get holy, and I want to come down and talk to you. They were like, whoa, 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 that's scary. And so they kind of put him in a box.
In a sense, yes. I mean, you think about his first real interaction with the whole people was there at Sinai. So he comes right down on this mountain. They aren't keen to approach. He kind of gives them this instruction, if you remember. Don't anyone come near. Don't even let animals come near. And they don't need to be told twice.
Yeah.
They eventually say, we don't even want to hear him. Moses, you go talk to him. You come back and tell us what he said. We don't even want to hear him. They were that terrified. But God does this thing with the tabernacle. And you're right. It is this beautiful thing where he doesn't go set it up in the far, far corner. And if anyone wants to come and talk to me, they can travel and go find. No, he puts himself right in the middle of them.
Mm-hmm.
So he is accessible.
Right.
And he makes priests so that there can be someone to go between the people and God. He wants that relationship. But he's also driving into them the fact he is so holy that you can't just wander into that tabernacle and go, hey, God, how's it going? No, well, there's some things that need to take place.
Yeah, and I think that's what Jesus is clarifying is that, yeah, there is this holiness problem. I've solved it.
Yeah.
But God wants you, like, without the veil.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So the tabernacle and the holy place and the most holy place, this was not God's ultimate design. He designed it this way for a purpose, for a period, for a certain people. But what did he want from the very beginning? How did he create it from the very beginning? A perfect world where people could be literally interacting with God. God would walk in the cool of the day in the garden with his creation. That's God's intention. That's what we see him in the book of Revelation describing we hope to return to. That's his objective. And now, through Christ, we're reading it here in chapter 9, there are things that Jesus was able to do, willing to do, to break down those barriers, to remove that separation, and to make sure that now we could have this relationship. Anything else about 1 through 14 before I go ahead and read 15 through the end of the chapter? Micah?
Something that sort of stood out to me, I don't know if we've already made the point or we will make the point, but that whenever he highlights the things that are in the ark, the manna, Aaron's rod, and the tablets. We talked in our last class sort of about the significance behind those, whether the authority or the law or God's provision. If you look back at those stories in the Old Testament, they got the manna after complaining. They got those tablets after making the golden calf.
Mm.
They got the Aaron's rod budded as a result of them questioning that. And you see some of those same warnings in the book of Hebrews.
Mm-hmm.
Of if you want to enter the rest, remember who this God is.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's something for us to...
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. Don't fall into the trap that the Israelites fell into. Trust God's provision. That's the manna. Respect his authority and those that he has put into authority. That's the priesthood. That's Jesus, right? And observe his law. And that's still, we're still bound by that same instruction, although we are under a different law and a different covenant now. So thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. All right, let's begin. Let's read starting in verse 15 of chapter 9. Therefore, Jesus, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. For where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you." And in the same way, he sprinkled with the blood both the tent and all the vessels used in worship. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Thus, it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has entered not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly, as the high priest enters the holy places every year with blood not his own, for then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. So, starting in verse 15, the author is connecting some dots here. What terms or ideas, specifically as we're looking in verses 15 through 18, what terms or ideas are presented here that have already been introduced? And what's the point that he's making here in this section? What? Covenant, okay. This is not the first time that covenant's been mentioned. Lloyd in the back.
Copies.
Copies.
Yes. So yep. In the shadow mentioned.
That's yep. Right. Copies and shadows. Oh, there's much more in here. What have we seen before? Promises. Yep. How does he refer to the Christians here? How does he refer to us?
Been called.
Ah, those who are called. That's not the first time he's used that particular phrase. What else? So just for reference, that was back in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 1. Holy brothers, those who share in a heavenly calling.
Death.
Death is throughout this, and that's going to be very important to this particular section.
Blood.
Blood. And in this section, he kind of uses those two words interchangeably. But yeah, blood is key. Key to the book of Hebrews, and certainly key to this section. Redeemed. What about in verse 15 that they may receive the promised eternal inheritance, the ESV says. This was a concept all the way back in chapter 1 as far as what Christ has inherited as the Son. We are referred to in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 17 as heirs of the promise. So the idea of inheritance, that's parents leaving for their children something after they die. And so the idea of God, not necessarily God after he dies, but God leaving an inheritance for his children. This is father-children kind of language. And that's going to be incredibly important, especially as we talk about this will, this last will and testament. So what's the point? This section, 15 through 18. Let's put some of those ideas together. Am
the necessity of death, just as a concept, when it comes to enacting a covenant or a will and testament.
Yes. Yeah, that death is necessary. Absolutely. So he returns to this idea that Jesus is our mediator. This was a concept introduced back in chapter 8. In chapter 8 and verse 6, as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. So Christ is reintroduced here as a mediator of a new covenant. And this covenant was discussed in length in chapter 8. It's a better covenant for a variety of reasons, but one of the key reasons of chapter 8 is it's enacted on better promises. And God has done so many things to make sure that we can count on and believe these promises. And this was the covenant that Jeremiah prophesied would come, something new, but not something wholly different. It was a completion of the original covenant, and it would finally be accomplished by the death or by the blood of Jesus. So it says in verse 16 that where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. There's this interesting thing that the language is doing here. The word will, or at least how we translate it in the English, will, is the same Greek word in verse 15 as covenant. That wasn't common. So there is I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce them, but there is a specific Greek word that's used quite a bit in Hebrews to denote covenant. But sometimes this particular one that's used, both in verse 15 and again in 16, is this word that in a religious context indicated not simply an agreement between two parties, but an agreement between two unequal parties. So the covenant that God made with human beings, we are not talking equal parties. There is one superior, and he's making a covenant with an inferior. God did that with Abraham. God did that with every human being he ever made a covenant with. And that's the word that's chosen here. When used in a religious way, that's how this word is used. But also, this Greek word was used in more of a secular way to mean a will, like a last will and testament. And so the author of Hebrews is actually kind of doing this interesting thing. He's using the same word, but in both ways. Not to say that every time you read the word covenant, it should be understood as a will. But in this particular instance, that is what he's doing. What's a will for? Why write a will? To leave something behind for whom? Yeah, and why would you do that? Do I leave a will behind for people I don't really like very much? Have them remember you. I think that's right, David.
That's the only way, like, I get a say in who gets what I have.
Ah.
Otherwise, there are laws that dictate where it has to go.
Yes, because if someone dies without making a will, someone else gets to decide what's done with that. And so a person, while they're still alive, writes a will because they want their will done. They want their decisions to be enacted even when they're not around to make sure that it happens. Also, it's a will, it's an inheritance, you're giving it to people that you love or giving it to friends. Why, though? Why leave things to take care of them? Because why? There it is. Because you love them. Most people are not going to leave some of their wealth to people they don't like. It usually doesn't happen that way. It is normally done because you love and care about typically family or people that you love, and you want to bless them with some of your wealth. God, again, the analogy is not perfect because God God the Father didn't die, but God did die and enacted this will. How? It seems obvious. Let's do the, everyone knows the answer. Because Jesus is God and Jesus died. And so the will was enacted. It couldn't have been. In fact, he says it's impossible. The death of one who made it must be established, for a will takes effect only at death. So God made this thing, but it wasn't going to be enacted until he died. And so at the death of Christ, this will was put in force. And so therefore, in verse 18... Let's get there. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. What's he saying here? Why bring that up? Yeah, both covenants require sacrifice. This is not a new concept, he's reminding them. Welcome to the book of Hebrews. This is not something like, whoa, I never saw that coming. He's been laying this groundwork from before the law of Moses was handed down at Sinai. In fact, God made a covenant with Abram through the death of something. And God made a covenant through Adam and Eve, and God made promises to them, and an animal had to die in order for that to happen. When Noah got off the ark, promises were made and animals died. God's been doing this from the beginning. And now he's saying, I'm establishing a new, better covenant, and it's better in all these ways, he's been saying in the previous chapters. And it's better because not just an animal died to make sure that you understood that this was enacted, but because Jesus himself. So he says in verse 19, for when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you. He's taking this from a passage back in Exodus chapter 24. So let's go back and read this passage. Exodus chapter 24. And I don't know about you, there are scenes in the biblical text that I read and go, man, I would have liked to have been there and seen that. Revelation is kind of the whole thing. Most of Revelation. This is one of those scenes. This is one of those scenes, especially here in verses 7 and 8. It says, starting in verse 1 of chapter 24 of Exodus, then he said to Moses, so God said, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but the others shall not come near, and the people shall not come up with him. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. I don't know. I would love more details, but the ones that are provided make me go, wow, I would have liked to have seen that. They ate and drank in the presence, in some way, in the presence of God. After making promises, they do it twice. They promise, all the Lord has spoken, we will do. Animals are killed, blood is sprinkled. And so this is the example that the author of Hebrews wants to remind his readers. Listen, God's been doing this from the beginning. Even the old covenant was enacted in this way. And what was sprinkled? I found this interesting. I had to kind of read up because I thought at first I misunderstood.
The people.
Okay, so in Exodus, we're told that the people were sprinkled. And this is where it gets interesting. So in Exodus, two things are mentioned that are sprinkled. What were they? The altar and the people. In Hebrews, it tells us what was sprinkled.
The book.
The book and the people. In fact, in verse 21 of Hebrews chapter 9, in the same way he sprinkled with the blood both the tent and the vessels used in worship. This cause a problem in any of your all's minds? Because it did with mine. Do you know that nowhere in the Old Testament are we told that the book of the law was ever sprinkled with blood? Nor are we told in the Old Testament that the tabernacle was ever sprinkled with blood. Now, the tabernacle was anointed with oil and the vessels with oil. The people most certainly were sprinkled with blood, not just on this occasion, but multiple occasions. So what's going on here? How do we explain this? Did the author of Hebrews not know his Old Testament very well? Is this causing anyone else consternation, or is it just me? What do you all think? In fact, I'll throw another one in there. The Exodus account does also not record anything about water or scarlet wool or hyssop. So it almost seems like the author is kind of taking a little bit of this of the story, a little bit of this, and putting it all together. And is that what he's doing? Is he, as someone I know would say, just playing fast and loose with the Old Testament scriptures? No, I agree with you, Anne-Marie. That's not what he's doing. How do you explain it? There are a couple of explanations, very logical explanations. But somebody give them to me. Okay, so the other practices weren't written down. What do you mean? Not yet, but would they be? Yes, when they got the law of Moses, there were elements of that worship and those things where water and hyssop and scarlet wool were part of some certain sacrifices, but not here in Exodus 24. And he's specifically quoting Exodus 24 when he uses it in verse 20. Could they have been, though, in the account in Exodus 24 and were just not told? It's entirely possible. In fact, numerous times in the New Testament, we are given details about Old Testament stories that we don't have in the text, but these inspired people did. So, for example, in Acts chapter 7, we're given additional information through Stephen's sermon here that God communicated certain things with Abraham while he was still in Mesopotamia. We don't have exactly that, but Stephen says it so, and he's clearly inspired. I mean, he can literally see up into heaven, guys. In that same passage, he says that the law of Moses was given how? Through angels. We don't necessarily read that, it's not a contradiction. It's some additional details that these guys had that are given. In Acts chapter 13 and verse 21, the length of King Saul's reign being 40 years was a piece of information we don't have from the Old Testament text, but these people did. And so for the writer of Hebrews to basically say, here's some additional pieces of information, I don't see a contradiction here. And maybe I'm making too much about nothing. But these are the things that I do kind of latch onto, because these are the types of passages that your non-Christian friends will point at and say, see, they didn't even know their source material. They couldn't even get the details right. And there is a very clear explanation here that the author is not just making things up. Any thoughts on that before we talk about what's the point that he's actually making here? Gary? Yes, we do. Thank you for that. In Hebrews 11, we're given an insight into Abraham's frame of mind when he's offering Isaac. He believed that God could raise him from the dead. So he believed, I could take him up there and actually kill him. God's got the power to raise him from the dead. We don't read about that in Genesis, but we're given additional details. So I read several different commentaries here about this, and the trouble that they seem to have with kind of, well, maybe, I mean, they didn't come out and say he was mistaken, but they just about did. But David McClisher offered, no, maybe they were just inspired by the Holy Spirit and had more information thousands of years later. Anne-Marie?
So it's that on the Day of Atonement, the mercy seat was sprinkled seven times for cleansing from Leviticus 16?
Yes.
Okay. So if the holy place is sprinkled, could that be the tabernacle?
Yes. So on the Day of Atonement, one of the things they were supposed to do every year was they would offer that animal on the bronze altar, right? They would then bring some of the blood into the most holy place, and they would sprinkle the Ark of the Covenant seven times, right? They were also supposed to dip some of that blood on the horns of the altar. The idea that maybe they also put blood on the tabernacle itself does not seem far-fetched. It doesn't to me, at least. Because he literally says in verse 22 here, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood. So just because we don't have a record of that specifically being done, it very well could have been, and it wouldn't have been out of God's character. Did we have a hand here? Yeah, Mindy.
Yeah, going along with another possible thing to think about, this may be uncomfortable in and of itself, but the Old Testament is not the only source material that New Testament writers drew on.
That's true.
We know that the guy who says about Cretans, as some of your own poets have said, and he references an extra biblical poem there.
Yeah.
He's making a certain point. Janus and Jamborees are never mentioned in the Old Testament, but they are in some Second Temple other literature.
Yeah.
And so they don't really hide the fact that they may be pulling, not necessarily canon, obviously, but they may be pulling from historically accurate other documents that
yeah,
are not the
absolutely.
Old Testament.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the idea that there are other documents out there from the same time period is undeniable. You can't get around it. But that just because the authors had access to them and quoted some of them doesn't inherently mean that the whole thing was therefore inspired. I don't think that's what you're saying. But yeah, we can't get around the fact that they obviously knew of them and quoted from them. The Book of Enoch is quoted a bit, I think. That thing is not inspired, and it doesn't take a genius to see it, but are there parts of it that seem to accurately depict some things? It seems to be that way. So yeah, I don't find that uncomfortable at all. Yeah.
I'm reading from the ESV Study Bible, and it's got a note that says, where is it? Authors add some specific details such as scarlet wool and hyssop and the sprinkling of the book itself, which are not mentioned in Exodus 24, 3 through 8. While the source of the author's information is unknown, these details are not improbable since the elements were used in other purifying ceremonies.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it seems very consistent with some of the instructions and the things that we do have. Yeah.
Also, you got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and all the writers are writing about the very same story, and yet they pull out the facts that are most interesting to them. So they don't all line up with the exact same thing. It's all in who's telling the story and who's writing it.
Yes.
And doesn't make it wrong, but some of them write things that the other ones didn't.
Yes. I don't think, and again, I don't think this is what you're saying, I don't think that you will find anywhere where the gospel writers contradict each other, but absolutely, they come at it from different purposes.
And they report different details.
Different details.
Yeah.
And clearly, this author is doing that because we talked about when he describes the tabernacle, he leaves out the courtyard. He doesn't mention the altar. He doesn't mention the water basin. It's not that those things weren't there, but he's trying to make a point. And so he's laser focusing on certain things. And I believe that's what he's doing here as well. Yeah, Katie.
I don't know if I'm just like really missing something, but what is the book that they're talking
book.
About?
Yes.
I don't know. I'm not thinking of what that is.
Are you going to answer the question for me? That'd be awesome. Okay, go for it.
I more have a question.
No.
Why are we assuming it's Exodus here when the tabernacle had, like, it's just being told about the tabernacle? Later, the same thing happens in Deuteronomy. That's when he's written the book. He's presenting the book. He reads the law again. And by then they would have the tabernacle.
Yes.
So is there a reason we're thinking it's Exodus and not the Deuteronomy?
The reason for that being verse 20 of Hebrews chapter 9, this is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you. He's quoting Exodus 24 right there. But you bring up a good point. The very next verse, he's referencing something that happens much later. And so what I think he's doing here, not only do I think the answer is he's inspired of God and is giving extra details that the original authors didn't provide, but I think he's also taking from the whole wilderness experience and the whole giving of the law and pulling several things together to make this point. And what's the point? Under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and this is key. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. This is the passage that you go to explain why did Jesus have to die in the first place. So when you have conversations with your atheist friends, why would you follow a God who would let his son die? That just seems cruel and mean. And on its face, if that's the only piece of information that you had, a father willingly let his son die, yeah, that's cruel, that's despicable. What good father would ever do that? You've got to take them to places like this and say, it was the only thing from the foundation of the earth, it's the only thing that was going to work to make purification for sins. Without it, there's no forgiveness of sins. And it's a plan that God has been setting up from the very beginning. And hopefully that spawns some good conversations. Okay, well then tell me more. How is that possible? Then you're getting into the law of Moses and sacrifices. Then you're going before to what happened in the garden. I find it a really great starting point, the book of Hebrews. Were there any other thoughts before we continue to move on? We've got... Oh, I'm sorry, the question that I dodged completely. Thanks, Gary, for that. I appreciate it a lot. I think it could be understood to be referring to the tablets themselves. I also think that when you read Exodus and you read the law, there was so much instruction given to those people, you could not possibly have fit all of that on small tablets of stone. They had to have written them down somewhere. They had to have written them down somewhere. So is that what's being referred to in Exodus 24? I'm inclined to think so. It's a different word than tablets. So that's my thought. Anne?
Well, in Exodus 24, it specifically talks about Moses writing down the words. And then in verse 7, it says he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And then verse 8, you know, it was quoted in Hebrews 9. So
yeah.
If he's piecing together different stories, it seems like this part of the story he's pulling from right here, that this is the same book that's
the book
being referenced.
Yeah. Yep.
They also, I mean, when we know there was some kind of a book. It was written down. We don't necessarily know the form or anything, but remember Josiah, they found the book. The book had been lost.
Correct.
And they found it in the temple. So, and he put it back into order.
Yes.
So I think it's the book of the law, in some form.
Yeah, I agree. Because what was the instruction that every king was supposed to do when he became king? Read it, but...
make a copy.
Write it. Most of the kings didn't do it, but they were supposed to, and that didn't mean just write out the Ten Commandments. No, they were supposed to write out the law, right? The instruction of all of that. Let's keep trucking along. I'd say I'd leave John in the lurch, but I'm going to leave myself in the lurch because I'm going to be teaching on Sunday. This point that without this blood, forgiveness is impossible. This was God's design from the beginning. Thus, it was necessary, in verse 23, for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. So if just the shadow of the thing required such extensive blood that they couldn't be purified and cleansed and put into service until the blood had been shed and sprinkled, how much more what Christ enacted by shedding his own blood. For Christ has entered, in verse 24, not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things. And he's kind of been talking in allusions up until now, but now he just says it outright. But he went into heaven itself. He went all the way into the very presence of God, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. And then he begins to again make these comparisons. He's done it before. He's going to do it more extensively, even in chapter 10, where he came as the priest, but he also came as the sacrifice. He wasn't coming in just with animal blood. He was coming in with his own. And he wasn't coming in year after year, over and over again, but he was coming in once for all into heaven itself. What key takeaways? We'll probably just get through verse 26 at this point, and that's okay. What key takeaways can we get from these verses? And this is a pretty open-ended question, but... okay, so we now know that God's perfect plan for the temple is now no longer a tabernacle, it's no longer a building, it's us. Okay, what else?
Well, there were sacrifices that were made often, but Christ's sacrifice is once for all.
Yeah. What did it say would be necessary in verse 26? To take care of the problem of sin, what would actually have been necessary if Jesus hadn't been offered? Suffering for how long? How much time?
Often.
Often. Since when? Since the time began. What should that teach us about sin? How serious is it? It's so serious that if a priest were to offer multiple times a day, every day, since the foundations of the world, it would not be enough to solve it. That's how serious sin is. It is an insurmountable problem. The consequences of mankind's sin is so dire that it would be necessary for a high priest to offer up sacrifices over and over and over again since the foundation of the world, and it never would satisfy the cost of sin. So let us never minimize the seriousness of it. And I know I do that. When I try to excuse it away, or I try to level sins, there are some that are really bad because our society says they are, and then there are some that are less. No. It was so bad that Christ came and offered himself. It was the only solution possible, and that is what covered it. We've got Tiffany.
Yeah, So is this why in 7:26 it says, for it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest? Is that what we're going back to?
Yeah, absolutely. It was indeed fitting. It was necessary. There was no other solution. The only other solution we had is for someone to do it all the time, every day, for eternity, and it still wouldn't solve it. It wouldn't be enough. Now, it was sufficient for the time for the people, but it was never going to satisfy. It was never going to solve the problem. And so one more takeaway as our time is running out. I take from verses 23 through 26, when he says in verse 26, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. God's timing and God's solutions are perfect. They are flawless. Christ came, we read in Galatians 4, verse 4, in the fullness of time, at exactly the right time. He came and he died one time at the right time for all time, providing exactly what mankind needed to fully take care of this. God's got this thing. He's got it. And so he is laying out this beautiful plan that God enacted for us, and that should give us confidence that the rest will come to fruition. Thank you all for your time and for your questions. We will continue right there in verse 27 on Sunday morning.